Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock, and you are tuned in to KTLO News on Wednesday, April 18th, 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juno afternoon. Today we'll talk with Anthony McMahon about making 1 million bones. Talk with Sean Launders and Hans Summers about their Saturday show, Whatever It Is, We're Against It. I'll talk to tonight's World Affairs Council Speaker Lou Pugliese about his talk, Renaissance of North American Oil. That's happening tonight at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. It's also happening here on a Juno afternoon. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely in the morning, then a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Forecast for Friday, more rain with low temperatures around 49 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. American Indian fire crews are ready to respond to this year's wildfire season. Mike Simonson has more.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs Wildland Fire Management Program has units ready to go across the country. Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Director Jim Zorn says this is a little-known but revered tribal resource.
They take great pride in that. There's a long tradition of tribal forest firefighting crews nationwide. They have these jump crews that have been around for years.
This tribal firefighting program dates back to 1933 when President Roosevelt formed the Indian Division of the Civilian Conservation Corps. BIA Midwest Region Fire Management Officer Tom Remus says these crews undergo intensive training.
As soon as you take that first class, you're a national resource. You're not just a Wisconsin or a Michigan or a Minnesota firefighter. You're a national resource. You're available to go anywhere.
Remus expects wildfire trouble in the southwestern United States soon, but they'll send crews anywhere from Florida to Alaska, not just Indian country. But most of the BIA firefighters are tribal members.
There's a lot of respect on a reservation for protecting your homeland and your natural resources that are very much held in high esteem on reservations. And, you know, in some locations, it's almost like the warrior culture into the fire culture, that they're held up there as guys that go out there and get it done.
Remus says they're usually on scene within 24 hours of getting the call. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson in Superior, Wisconsin.
Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Bill John Baker will sign a bill intended to protect journalists. The tribe is enacting the Free Press Protection and Journalist Shield Act so that journalists won't have to disclose their sources. It's modeled after the state of Oklahoma's Shield Law. The Cherokee Nation says it's one of the first tribes in the country to offer journalists protection from revealing their sources. It does not apply to defamation, libel, or slander cases, and excludes court proceedings where no other witnesses are available to provide the same information. The Shield Law was adopted unanimously by the Tribal Council meeting this month. A ceremony is scheduled for Thursday in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Funeral services are being held for a woman thought to be the oldest member of the Chickasaw Nation. KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports.
Daisy Holly Blackbird was 4 years old when Oklahoma became a state in 1907. She died Thursday in Oklahoma City at the age of 109 after a short illness. Blackbird was born in 1903 in Tupelo in Indian Territory. Her Chickasaw maternal grandparents were removed from tribal lands in the east, forced to live in what would become Oklahoma. She was the widow of former Oklahoma Supreme Court Justice William Henry Blackbird. Her funeral is set for 2 Wednesday afternoon at the First Christian Church in Oklahoma City. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper signed an indigenous language bill this week. According to the Durango Herald, under the law, schools can hire indigenous language teachers, even if they are not certified educators, but would work with certified teachers. It's modeled after the Lakota language program in Denver Public Schools. The state has 2 Ute tribes and borders the Navajo Reservation. During this month in 1974, the song Come and Get Your Love by the Native American rock band Redbone was certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America. The band was formed by Yaki and Shoshone brothers Lolly and Pat Vegas. Redbone had an earlier hit with the song Witch Queen of New Orleans that topped the charts in 1972. The band was inducted into the Native American Music Awards Hall of Fame in 2008. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Hell, baby,
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2013. Applications will be accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/social work. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTLO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guest is Ann Kim McNaughton, who's going to be trying to make her share of $1 million. This is coming up Sunday, April 22nd from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Sketch Studio. MK, thank you for coming down to the station today.
My pleasure.
So this is, the whole project is called $1 million. You want to describe it, if you could, please?
Sure. And I found out about it because a friend of a friend emailed me. They were looking for a representative in every state capital to help with this national project that was conceived by artist Naomi Natal. She had a vision of taking 1 million handmade bones, bones made out of clay and plaster, and laying them in the mall in Washington, D.C. as a wake-up, a way to educate and start discussion about preventing future atrocities, mass genocides. And that was very inspiring to me. And not only has she taken on this project and recruited people from around the country to help make the bones, she is working with a group called Students Rebuild, and they work with kids. And so I thought, genocide with school kids, what a project to take on, and read more about it. And I'm really impressed with all of the players involved, in addition to the public art piece that's going to be created and the conversation that it will spark. They've partnered with the CARES Foundation, which does relief work in other parts of the world, and for people who donate bones, that they are going to donate up to $500,000 to do work in Somalia and the Democratic Republic of Congo. So the bones that are made as this project, including the bones in Juneau, will help raise money for relief work.
And the bone making workshop happens this Sunday. And how many bones do you plan on making here in Juneau?
I am hoping to make 2,500 bones, and I have about 150, so I only need 2,350 or so.
What's the process of making a bone?
I'm using plaster strips, forming it around old newsprint, and it's fun to work with. It's possible for all ages, whether you are comfortable doing art or not. It's tactily a very fun medium. You dip it in warm water, and that activates the plaster, and just rub it around the form that you've created with paper, and it hardens pretty quickly.
Is it pretty much anatomically correct?
I am trying, and thanks to you, I have a skeleton to look at, which is really helpful.
This happened at Sketch Studio. For you personally, what would hook you into the project?
I have all my life been kind of overwhelmed by media stories of horrible things that happen throughout the world, including in our own, you know, on our own doorsteps. Sometimes when you hear a lot of news of war and battle and atrocity, I shut down a little bit, and I'm not proud of that. And when this project came across my email, I thought, this is something that appeals to me as a visual artist and as a social justice activist. I think through my hands, and I respond to visual images. And Naomi Natal describes, after Rwanda, she wondered if we'd taken all the victims and physically laid them down in the street in D.C., could our nation have ignored such a mass genocide? And that spoke to me. It's very hopeful, too. So it's talking about a serious project, issue, but it's a way to start conversation with youth, and that's a positive way to deal with a really negative issue, and that's appealing to me.
How many people are involved across the country?
Oh, good question. I know they were hoping to have every state capital have an installation of bones on the 28th of April, which is two Saturdays from now, And I think they have 35 states. I just got the email about a month ago, so it's a kind of quick turnaround for me to produce 2,500 bones and have an installation, but we're going to make it happen. And then in 2013, next spring, she's planning the 1 million bones in D.C. So they filmed a couple of the first installations. There's one in Albuquerque that's very powerful, just a three-minute video showing what it looks like to lay down. I think they laid down 50,000 bones in that installation, and it's very powerful. So we're going to do our part.
You're making 2,500 bones here in Juneau, and what's going to happen with the bones once you've made them?
Then I will mail them to the artist for her upcoming installation.
But you're going to put them on display here in Juneau?
Well, on the 28th, we are going to have an installation on the dock. So on the 22nd, this Sunday, is the workshop, and people are welcome to drop in from 3 to 5 to help make bones. I need about 235 people to spend an hour with me, and maybe we'll finish.
Or one person to spend 235 hours.
Yeah, or that, if someone wants to dedicate themselves. And then the following Saturday, the 28th, at 4 o'clock, we'll meet on the dock behind Marine Park. The shelter's kind of under construction right now, but we'll meet on the dock. And Ryan Cortez has volunteered to film the installation, and Flor Delino Lagandino is going to take some photos that we can send into the National Project. We won't have the number of bones that, say, Albuquerque or New Orleans did. They each had 50,000 bones in their installation. So I decided what was important was to see a little bit of our environment here. So on the waterfront, I think the bones contrasted on the wood with the mountains in the background will represent Juneau. And another thing that's, I think, appealing about this project is that it's recognizing things that are happening throughout the world, but including things that have happened in our own history within Alaska. Native peoples have been displaced, and it's an opportunity, I think, to locally talk about what's happened in our state.
So if people are interested in helping out making the 2,500 bones, they should come dressed in bone-colored clothing?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, in Albuquerque, they did wear all white, and that was one of the requirements of being an organizer. And when it was the only requirement I had an issue with, I called up the person who was the national coordinator and said, I have a problem with making Junoites show up in all white. I don't think most of us own all white clothing, and it just doesn't culturally really fit here. And it could be snowing, you know, it could be snowing in a week. You never know. So I do appreciate the artist's intention, though, to have a strong visual piece. So I'm asking people to wear all dark clothing, all brown or black, or things that don't have pattern in them, because when the video's done, you don't want to look at it and say, oh, I really like that one sweater. See that hot pink sweater? I really like that. I wonder where she got that. That kind of takes away from the art. It's an art installation that's happening. So just wearing kind of neutral colors, jeans and solid color things that don't have advertisements on them would be great.
So if time-wise you don't come up with 2,500 bones this Sunday at the Sketch Studio, I'm not sure if you could fit that number, the 235 people into the Sketch Studio, number one. Will you be working on it during the course of the week?
I probably not. I'm going to try to do as much as I can on the weekend, have a big push. And I've asked my landlord for permission to use the parking lot outside of my studio. So nobody knows where my studio is. There isn't a sign yet. It's kind of a private studio, but it's located on the corner of Front and Main Street, and that little parking lot next to Kenny's restaurant is pretty visible right across from the big parking lot, and that's where I'll be. I've borrowed tables, and if it's raining, I'm hoping to borrow the tents from the Jack, and I'm hoping it's not raining, though. We'll just make bones, and if people want to drop in for a little while, that's great, from 3 to 5.
You want to direct people to the website?
Yes, 1 million bones. .org, 1millionbones.org. And they have a really beautiful video. There's a picture of a man in the little image that pops up. There are several videos. There's a video about the artist. There's a video about different installations. But the Albuquerque video is, I think, really helpful to watch. It talks about the whole project. You get to visually see an installation, and that explains it better than my words do, I think.
If people have questions specific to the Juno event, is there a number they can call you at?
Yes, they can call me at 957-2061. I'm on Facebook, MK MacNaughton. That's an M-A-C, a Mac. And people can email me, too, mkmac@gci.net.
Just meet this Sunday, April 22nd from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Sketch Studio, which is across the street from Sea Alaska Building and Parking Lot.
Correct. On the corner. And there's a beautiful quote. Can I read that?
Please.
On the 1 Million Bones website. When we do something with our hands, it changes the way we think, which changes the way we feel, which changes the way we act. And in addition to everything else, that all the other parties that are part of this, they're the Senate, there are two senators that have proposed a resolution to address preventing massacres. And they say that preventing genocide and mass atrocities is an achievable goal, and it's in the interest of our nation to do this. So they're working on passing this resolution, and that's another part of the installation coming up next year. So I think of it as a really positive project, and I invite people to participate with that in mind, that it's a way to start conversation and to prevent future atrocities.
M.K. MacNaughton, thank you very much for coming down to the station today and talking about the 1 Million Bones project and the project to make 2,500 bones this Sunday. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, it's fun, so I encourage people to join me. Thanks.
Ezekiel cried them dry bones, Ezekiel cried them dry bones, Ezekiel cried them dry bones, oh hear the word of the Lord. The foot bone connected to the ankle bone, the ankle bone connected to the leg bone, the leg bone connected to the knee bone, the knee bone connected to the thigh bone, oh hear the word of the Lord. The thigh bone connected to the hip bone, the hip bone connected to the back bone, the back bone connected to the neck bone, the neck bone connected to the head bone, oh hear the word of the Lord. Them bones wanna walk around, them bones wanna walk around, them bones wanna walk around, oh hear the word of the Lord. The head bone connected to the neck bone, the neck bone connected to the backbone, the backbone connected to the hip bone, the hip bone connected to the thigh bone, oh hear the word of the Lord. The thigh bone connected to the knee bone, the knee bone connected to the leg bone, the leg bone connected to the ankle bone, the ankle bone connected to the foot bone. Oh, hear the word of the Lord. Oh, hear the word of the Lord. Oh, hear the word of the Lord.
Time is 3:19, 3:20, and you are tuned to KTVO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about some social political commentary. Comedy, whatever it is, we're against it. Sean Landers and Hans Summers.
Hi. greetings.
Also, Eric Caldwell from the group Morally Impoverished. Thank you very much for coming down.
No problem. Oh,
thank you for having us, Jeff.
So first of all, Eric, could you talk about Morally Impoverished?
Morally Impoverished is a local improvisational theater group that's been around since 2004. We're doing a combination of improv formats, just trying to capture the whole genre, not just comedy, not just drama, but pretty much anything that's unscripted.
And Sean and Hans, you're doing some social political comedy?
Yeah, it have been for, oh my goodness, for since 1986.
Since 1986, yep.
A little Second City style, very solid. We always figured that comedy, good comedy, comes from a social political stance where you can say stuff that's funny that's about the world around you, which makes it interesting. That's what we try to do.
What came first, the act or the relationship?
Both at the same time. I auditioned for his theater company.
Right, 1986.
Yeah,
we had been, my company had been producing the first multimedia comedy in Chicago. And we were going into a second run, and we were having casting for new actors. And I came in for casting.
I had just finished doing working in prisons, doing social political drama in prisons and penitentiaries. And I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to be funny. Can't be funny around people who have done really bad crimes. So
you can be.
Yeah, you can be.
They
get it, but death might be involved. So I auditioned for his company, and he was the dissenting vote of not having me in his company.
That's true.
Yes,
this is a true story.
It's a true story. He didn't want me in the company, and I got in, and we've been together ever since.
Whatever it is, we're against it is playing Saturday night at 7 o'clock at the Hangar Ballroom.
Yes.
Going through dozens of improv shows throughout the country.
This is actually my... Alaska is officially the final state of me performing in. I have now officially been in every single state performing at some point in my life. And I'm very excited. This is the most beautiful city I have seen. There is not one place we have been to since I have been here since Tuesday that doesn't have a view.
And your last two that you played in were
Hawaii
and Alaska.
And now here's Alaska.
So it's apropos.
It's absolutely fantastic. So I'm really excited to, you know, kind of kick off Saturday as my final. I have to go and do the rounds again. I have to start now back in Arkansas
and work around the country again.
So I'm very excited. And we're really looking forward to it. This town has a great theater community. An amazing comedy community, and I'm just tickled to be here.
So. Could you describe the show for me?
It is two-person improvisational sketch show that is a culmination of the improvisation that we've done throughout the country. So what we do is we improvise, and then we write it out, and then we do sketch comedy.
Yeah, we do a lot of Lotsies.
Yeah.
So if you're familiar with Curb Your Enthusiasm, on HBO.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way they structure their scripts. You have points where you want to hit, but you don't know how you're going to get there.
Yeah. So we have a very Lotsy-based show, but it basically all of this culminated with the idea of the politics that are going on in this country and how everyone can express themselves very well and using signs to try to express themselves, not well-written signs or grammatically correct signs, but they're having a hard time expressing themselves. So many different varying opinions. When we opened up the show, Occupy had just started, the big boon of Occupy. So we're using a little bit of that, the same kind of theory of what's going on in the economy and how that's restructuring and how people are, you know, like a mini revolution, but not well organized. I'm not a well organized.
Yeah, that's kind of a
the revolution might be YouTube, not a televised. It might be YouTube.
So it's kind of a compilation. Our last show, and then we're working on a new show you're putting up in July in Hollywood.
Yes. And so we're going to use bits of that, but it's all straight political social comedy and improvised, too. We're going to be improvising with Morally Impoverished, which we're really looking forward to. I've known Eric here for quite a while.
Several years.
And coincidentally, initially online through the improv community nationally, and really looking forward to improvising with you, Kat.
Yeah, we're bringing out a format that was originally done in Chicago by the Georgia Pacific Company called The Bat.
The Bat,
where we turn out the lights and let it go.
For all purposes, I call it in the dark radio.
Yeah, improvising radio.
Improvising in radio.
Are some things funny just inherently, or is it the matter of the way they're viewed?
I think it's...
Or something inherently funny?
Funny bones?
Yeah, I always think of that anybody can learn how to do comedy, but some people are just naturally funny. And regardless of what they do, it'll come out humorous.
Yeah, I think
funny bones is the old terminology.
Funny bones is the old theory, which is you are naturally funny. It's no matter what you do, it just comes out. No matter what the viewpoint is, it always comes out funny. I really think it is viewpoint in a lot of ways. I do believe people are naturally funny, but it's the perspective of that generation. You know, what was hilarious in 1933 will probably not fly in 2012 and reverse. But I think there's always something naturally funny in something that happens.
If people can empathize with it, it'll be
funny. The idea of, you know, if I cut my finger, it's tragedy. But if, you know, you slip on a banana peel and fall in a manhole, that's comedy. There's always something that is inherently funny from a person's viewpoint. So
Chicago, the home of Mike Nicholson and Lynn May.
Did
you share something with us here?
Give us something that's been... Sir, you're so handsome. You don't have a face for radio. I think you're very handsome. Can you give me a suggestion? Something political that you've been thinking about.
Or social.
Social, political.
Well, next, I guess we're going to be talking about oil development.
Oil development? Okay.
So you want to go around town here? Is that
what's the elevation here?
The elevation.
So anyway, I just love how it's like where Christmas trees come and be born. I was thinking of moving here, and I was really hoping. I was just extremely hoping if I could, you know, just wondering if you if there was any oil that I could drill for.
Any oil you can drill for?
I have a stick.
That's nice. So exactly where are you from, lady?
I'm from Elgin, Illinois.
Elgin, Illinois.
Yes,
that's
Elgin,
great. I've heard that's like the New York of the Midwest.
Yes, it is. I just love the idea. I'm just so surprised that oil is just not shooting out of the ground here. I mean, that's what I heard.
You heard that, huh?
I heard oil shoots from the ground.
It's kind of like the tourists coming over here thinking the streets are full of gold.
Aren't they?
Elgin, Illinois, you said.
Elgin, Illinois. Uh-huh. It's the land of meat. So anyway, I was just wondering if you could just take me where the oil is.
Okay, I'll take you where the oil is. You see over here, this is a Citgo.
That's a really nice, that's where the gas is.
Exactly, that's where the oil comes from.
It comes from the Citgo?
The oil gets made into the gas, and it ends up here at the Citgo. And you bring your car, and you plug your car up. Unless you have one of them hybrids. Then you're hoity-toity, and you just need electricity.
And I don't have that at all. No, I want to be rich, really, and I hear it.
Doesn't everyone?
But it's so much more opportunity here in Alaska. I mean, it's still the last unmarked territory, Elgin. There's so many Stuckies. There's a ton of Stuckies. I used to own a Stuckies.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah.
Big fan of pecans, are you?
I love pecans.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I want to come out here, because you make so much more money in oil.
You want to bring pecans to the Alaskans, do you?
We
love pecans here.
That's great. Look, I don't want to sound rude or
presumptuous
or anything.
I expect that a tourist. You're very inquisitive. You want to find out about our culture, right?
I really do.
Okay.
I really, really want to be rich because I have no other alternatives. And so tell me, how long have you been doing this tour route? Are you single?
You're a
comely man.
Yeah, well,
you're handsome.
Thank you.
I see the oil underneath your fingers.
Yeah,
or is that just
I was
dirt?
Working on my car. Yeah,
oh, okay. Assumed that. Yeah, so, I mean, everyone here in Alaska must have an oil field.
No, not everybody, actually. I just drive these tours, and I do some fishing once in a while.
You never know. You might catch a fish, a whale, or just hit a geyser out of the middle of the bay. You never know what's going to happen. I've been single for so long. I'm single too.
I always thought I'd want to find somebody. I just never figured I'd find him in Alaska.
But here I am.
Sean Nichols and Hans Summers do a little improv. You can tell some of that is improv and some of it has been honed with your personal relationships for years and years.
Our talkovers, we do this in real life. None of that was scripted. We just riffed. But we've been working together for so long, it's just easy to play.
whatever it is, we're against it. Where did that come from?
Actually, it came directly from the Marx Brothers.
From the Groucho song.
From the Groucho song, whatever it is, we're against it, from the movie.
Coconuts, I think.
No, actually, it is from.
It's from
horse feathers.
It's from Horse Feathers, and literally the song pretty much summed up everything that we feel about politics and how people cannot express themselves. Whatever it is, you're against it. If you say it's blue, somebody else will say it's red, not because they don't believe in it, just because they have to. And that's what we make fun of. The idea of, you know, if I turn around and say, you know, I really believe in the ecosystem, I'm almost positive somebody in the universe who realizes my political affiliation and go, I'm completely against it. You know, and meanwhile, 3 hours later, they're talking to the same person who believes in what they believe in, go, I really am for it. It's that separation of weirdness, of relationships of people between our politics that we make fun of because it's easy, breezy, and fun to do.
You're doing workshops while you're in town?
I'm sorry?
Doing workshops while you're in town?
Yes, I'm doing two workshops. I'm bringing improvisational theater back to script productions. Initially, improvisation was considered a process into writing, and it has turned into an art form, and justly so, which I love to do, but I'm bringing it back to a tool to use to write. So you improvise, and you take what you've improvised to write it down into actual production, scripted two-act production, so I'm going to be teaching that.
Which is what we do all the time.
Yeah, and I'm teaching two-person improv, where only two people can get up. There's so many ensembles throughout the country that have six or more ensemble members. I can turn around and say, you can do this with two people just as long as the connection is there. So, you know, just the basic skills. It's harder to do with two people.
How do you establish that connection?
You establish it by listening. It's really that simple. It's a real honed skill. If you're not listening to the gift, the offer is what we call it in theater, the offer that's given to you, You are missing beats throughout the improvisational scene that you're doing. So the object is to really listen and to really react and respond to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a basic rule of improv. Listen, respond.
React, respond. Listen, react, respond. And that is actually a skill. People don't do it in real life well.
Yeah, there are a lot of people you meet that are listening to you and they're going to respond to what you're saying. There's other people that are listening, but they're not listening. They're waiting to talk.
And
that's the problem. Those kind of people, it's rough to teach them improv because they're not listening to the other actors.
You're taking it out of that into a much more active listening, and it helps because you do not have a script. It's a natural flow into scenic work. So if you're really listening and responding, instead of trying to be funny, you react and respond, and the funny will be there. If you're just reacting and responding. And that's kind of the skill sets that I'm teaching for the two-person improv.
Eric, you want to give us the details on the workshops and the performances, please?
Yes, the workshops for two-person improv is going to be Saturday from 1:30 to 4:30. The Improv in the Scripted Theater is from 9 a.m. until noon. The show itself, whatever it is, we're against it, begins at 7 p.m., Tickets for the show, registration for the workshops, those are available at Hearthside Books, at the JAC, and at jhc.org.
Also, if you find me on the street, you can buy a ticket, too. I will be the African-American woman wandering around, you know. You can't miss me. I'm wearing a fuzzy hat.
Is the show good for all ages?
It's not all ages.
No, it is 21 and over. The Hangar Ballroom is serving beer and alcohol during the shows, so we've had to restrict the age range.
Beer and alcohol?
Beer and other alcohol. Beer and beer.
It's the kind of beer that's not quite beer. It's near the beer.
It's the harder spirits.
It's the harder spirits that really makes the 12-year-olds not come in.
And like the old adage goes, the more you drink,
the funnier
we
get. So there you go.
Sean Landers and Hans Summers from the group. You'll be performing whatever it is, we're against it. Saturday at 7 o'clock at the Hangar Ballroom. Do you have a website?
The website for our stuff is www.landry, L-A-N-D-R-Y, and summers.com. And you can reach us there and see all of our stuff.
Or Facebook.
Or our Facebook, which is Landry and Summers. Or you can tweet us at Landry_Summers. We're really online.
your Tomorrowland Beverage website?
Right now, we're just on our Facebook page. If you go into your Facebook search and look for Morally Impoverished, you'll find us there.
All right. Thanks for coming by, everybody. Right,
thank you so much.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, sir, he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.
Knowing Dad as I do, I'd not advise you to displease him or tease him. No, no. Don't double-cross him or toss him around. When dear old Dad once gets mad, he's a hound.
My son is right, I'm quick to fight, I'm from a fighting clan. When I'm abused or badly used, I always get my man. No matter if he's in Peru, Paducah, or Japan, I go ahead alive or dead, I always get my man. I soon dispose of all of those who put me on the pan. Like Shakespeare said to Nathan Hale, I always get my man. I always get my man.
Hi, this is Clay Good. I'm hosting the next event in the KRNN concert series April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Goldtown Theater. Ed Littlefield and Christian Fabian will perform original music they call Native Jazz, fusing traditional clinket and European melodies with jazz to create a totally unique sound. Both are professional musicians, composers, and performers. This is a show you definitely won't want to miss. April 25th at the Goldtown Theater. Tickets at krnn.org, the station, or at the door.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 18th of April, 2012. It was on this day, 1958, the U.S. government dropped its treason charges against the poet Ezra Pound, and he was released from St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital in Washington, where he'd been held for almost 13 years for having made radio speeches from Rome during World War II, praising Mussolini and the fascists and blaming the war on the Jews. Ezra Pound was 72. He'd been visited during those 13 years by an odd combination of white supremacists who liked his politics and distinguished American writers who admired his poetry or his history of generosity to other writers, including Robert Frost, who testified in his behalf and said, "None of us can bear the disgrace of our letting Ezra Pound come to his end where he is. It would leave too woeful a story in American literature." And it's the birthday of the beat poet Bob Kaufman, born in New Orleans, 1925, who helped found Beatitude magazine. His books, includes Solitudes Crowded with Loneliness, which came out in 1965. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, entitled The Starfish. It is low tide, fog. I have climbed down the cliffs from Pierce Ranch to the tide pools. Now the ecstasy of the low tide, kneeling down alone. In 6 inches of clear water, I notice a purple starfish with 19 arms. It is a delicate purple, the color of old carbon paper or an attic dress. At the webs between the arms, sometimes a more intense sunset red glows through. The fingers are relaxed, some curled up at the tips with delicate rods, apparently globes on top of each, as at world fairs, waving about. The starfish slowly moves up the groin of the rock, then back down. Many of its arms rolled up now, lazily, like a puppy on its back. One arm is especially active and curves up over its own body, as if a dinosaur were looking behind him. How slowly and evenly it moves. The starfish is a glacier going 60 miles a year. It moves over the pink rock by means I cannot see, and into marvelously floating, delicate brown weeds. It is about the size of the bottom of a pail. When I reach out to it, it tightens and then slowly relaxes. I take an arm and quickly lift. The underside is a pale tan. Gradually, as I watch, thousands of tiny tubes begin rising from all over the underside, hundreds in the mouth, hundreds along the 19 underarms, all looking, feeling, like a man looking for a woman, tiny heads blindly feeling for a rock and finding only air. A purple rim runs along the underside of every arm, with paler tubes, probably its moving feet. I put him back in. He unfolds. I had forgotten how purple he was, and slides down into his rock groin, the snail-like feelers waving, as if nothing had happened, and nothing has. A poem, The Starfish, by Robert Bly, from his selected poems, published by Harper Perennial, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Juno Pride Chorus invites you to come walk with us on Saturday, April 21st at the Jack. Hear selections they'll be taking to the Gala Chorus's International Festival in Denver. Check out the silent auction at 6:30 and then find your seat for the 7:30 performance at the Jack Saturday, April 21st. Get your tickets today from chorus members at the Jack or at the door. Come walk with us is sponsored by PFLAG Juno and the Pride Foundation.
Time is 3:44, and you are tuned in to KTLO News in Juneau. In studio with me are Jim Clark from the Juneau World Affairs Council and Lou Bularisi. Tonight's World Affairs Council speaker will be talking on the coming renaissance in North American oil. Lou and Jim, thank you very much for coming on the station with me today.
Well, we're very, very pleased to be here. Very fortunate to have Lou Bularisi speaking to us tonight on the coming renaissance of oil and gas in the United States. And I think our speakers will find him, Our audience will find him very, very interesting. He's worked for 5 different federal agencies, writes often for the Wall Street Journal, speaks Russian, and was involved in everything from EPA to the National Security Council inside the White House. So he's very knowledgeable on the oil and gas issues.
He's also the president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation. Lou, thank you for coming down to the show. And can you describe your organization, please?
Yes. EPRINC, Energy Policy Research Foundation, was founded in 1944. We're an independent, nonprofit institution, and we publish regularly on the economics of petroleum issues. And we've been doing so for 67 years.
Describe what you mean by renaissance and why you think it's on the horizon.
In 2010, the United States became the largest producer of natural gas in the world. We will remain in that position for the next 40 years, at a minimum. And the reason that happened is a marriage of both art and science. The breakthroughs in horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, combined with understanding of the techniques and the nature of the reservoirs, brought about a revolution in natural gas production. And in fact, the interesting thing about that is it starts in Texas, moves to Oklahoma, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and now with an application to oil production in North Dakota. And everywhere that we've had production of gas and oil in the United States has something called source rock, and that source rock is applicable to this technology.
How does Alaska fit in?
Alaska fits in two ways. One way is that the lessons of the shale gas revolution show that if we have an open system, because remember, the shale gas revolution takes place all on private land, and that means that ideas and technology can migrate very quickly. So I think the lessons for Alaska is we probably need a federal government that can open up more areas to development, a more open system so that technology and ideas can move so that we can get the benefits of greater oil and gas production.
How long do you think the renaissance will last?
I think the renaissance is either a permanent or semi-permanent development. That is, it will go way beyond our lifetime and our children's lifetime.
How do North American supplies compare with the oil in the Mideast or in Russia? You did a lot of work in Russia.
Reserve data is very, very tricky. If you would go back and look at the geological survey reports at the turn of the century or 1930, 1940, it would always say we only had 20 years supply. I mean, it's very interesting. If you take the last 30 years, we've only had enough production to produce an additional 20 or 30 billion barrels. But in the last 20 or 30 years, we produced 150 billion barrels. So the size of the resource base is a very elastic thing. It's overwhelmed by technology. And that's what's happening now. The technology is moving much faster, and it's a much more important feature than the size of the reserve base.
Is this technology like fracking?
Fracking, horizontal drilling, pipe that can bend underground, the ability to precisely identify where the pay zones are. It's a multitude of technologies. And I say it requires a marriage of both art and science.
These technologies weren't available 10 or 15 or 20 years ago.
They were not widely available 15 or 20 years ago. Actually, the process of hydraulic fracturing has been around a long time. It just didn't get very efficient or cost-effective until the last 10 years.
So if you had the President Obama in the room right now, what would your advice be to him?
My advice to President Obama would be to embrace the North American oil and gas renaissance and not create a lot of uncertainty about its potential. I would also suggest that he approve the Keystone Pipeline and open up the ANWR and do a lot of things that would enhance the potential of North America to produce more oil and gas, because it's going to become a key feature of our economic growth. We are now the lowest cost producer of natural gas in the world. Our petrochemical companies are going to be very, very cost effective and productive in dominating world export markets.
And as oil from other countries fit into the equation?
I think it's going to shift what we call east of Suez. That by the next 10 or 15 years ago, looking forward, the entire Western Hemisphere, with the subsalt discoveries in Brazil, what's going on in Colombia, North America, we will not be importing any oil what we call east of Suez. We won't be importing any oil into the Western Hemisphere from the Middle East.
What about Russia?
I think Russia is got two interesting opportunities and problems. One problem for Russia is that its largest asset, which is natural gas, is going to have diminished value over time. But it will continue to be a major oil producer, and it's producing around 10 million barrels a day now. I don't think it's going to go up substantially higher, but if it does the right kinds of policies, it will be able to sustain its current level of production.
All this oil and gas is available here in the United States. How come prices keep going up?
Well, prices go up for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons they're going up is because in the near term, demand is exceeding supply, and there's a risk premium, a set of expectations that there might be a disruption. But if you look at the futures market, you know, what buyers and sellers think about the future, it's what the futures traders call it's backward dated. In other words, you can buy a barrel of oil 5 years from now for much less than you have to pay for it now, because most buyers and sellers in the market believe that these additional supplies will eventually come along, and that the current sort of security issues will tend to get worked out.
When you look at oil production and prices and all the various factors mm-hmm. that go on in the world, do you look at just the oil production, or do you look at cultural issues and political issues as well?
We try to look at political issues when we do reports and assessments. And as a result, we end up looking at cultural issues, but I don't think we have a lot of expertise in that.
How high do you think gas prices will go before the United States and the rest of the world gets really serious about alternative energy?
Well, the question of alternative energy is a question of cost. We've written extensively about biodiesel and ethanol and biofuels. And part of the problem is how our policies are implemented. For example, we think the ethanol policy is not implemented in a way that allows for its maximum use in a cost-effective way. The tendency of the government to issue mandates tends to be very unproductive, because it can't adjust for the fact that prices can move around radically. So probably the right answer for us is to put a lot of money into research and alternatives, but to deploy them when they're cost-effective. And many of them are not cost-effective. And actually, a big dilemma right now is the fact that the U.S. is going to go through a long period of relatively low natural gas prices. And that means alternatives to natural gas, such as coal and nuclear, as well as wind and solar, are going to be very difficult to deploy.
I'm talking to Lou Pulirisi. He's talking tonight at the World Affairs Council in the Juno Arts and Culture Center on the coming renaissance in North American oil. Starts at 5 o'clock at the Juno Arts and Culture Center Gallery Room. So what got you interested in oil and gas? When you were growing up, did you think I'm going to be an oil and gas kind of guy?
No. My first job in the Interior Department was working on the royalty bidding experiment when I was just out of college.
So the what?
The royalty bidding experiment.
Okay.
At that time, in the mid to late 1970s, the government wanted to experiment with other ways of transferring oil and gas assets for private development. Instead of a traditional bonus bid where the potential developers, whoever pays the most, gets the asset and then they pay a certain royalty, they wanted to open it up to more people. They said, well, just bid a percentage. Turned out that was not a good system, because some people would bid a very high percentage, but then they wouldn't be able to develop the resource because the percentage they bid was too high.
What else are you going to be talking about tonight?
I'm going to talk about tight oil and how the technology has caused this revolution to take place, and how many of the expectations our policymakers and people have about the scarcity of oil and gas over time appear to be quite unfounded.
How much oil is around?
More than we can use.
Where is it? Is it in North Dakota, South Dakota, Texas?
It's everywhere. There has been oil production in the past. There can be new oil production today because these areas have source rock. So we are seeing a huge resurgence in North Dakota. We're seeing in the next year, we're going to see a lot of new oil production and gas production from Ohio. We're going to have a renaissance of the Rust Belt. Texas is likely to see its production rise to 4 million barrels a day in the next 10 to 12 years. And we're going to have a massive opportunity for value-added processing. refineries, petrochemical plants, the production of all the products from natural gas liquids. So it's an amazing development that's taking place.
And if you'd prefer to be part of it?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting area for research.
All right, Lou Polarisi talking tonight about the coming renaissance in North American oil at 5 o'clock at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. It's absolutely free. Lou or Jim, is there anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, we just like to make sure that as many people as possible come, because this is such a timely issue for Alaska. And as you said, it's free, and there'll be an opportunity for questions, so it should be an interesting evening.
All right, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Glacier Valley Rotary Club presents the 20th annual Pillars of America. On April 25th, hear Josh Shipp, a noted teen communications expert and the host of the TV show Jump Ship, as he offers up a healthy dose of advice that he calls in your face but on your side at the Pillars of America at Centennial Hall on April 25th. Tickets available at both locations at Hearthside Books, and lunches included.
It's 3:58 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. Coming up tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with Rabbi Dov Gartenberg and Jeff Kirsch about the upcoming evening of Yiddish comedy. Leslie Wood will be here to highlight this Saturday's Juneau Pride Chorus. Mary Levischuk from the Gloria Hall will be here to fill us in on the Empty Pools Banquet on Sunday. And Nancy DeTourney will be here to give us a rundown on art happenings in the capital city during Arts Up. Matt Redder's Almanac Music, more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like increasing clouds with a chance of rain later on, low temperatures around 37 degrees. Rain likely tomorrow morning, then scattered rain showers in the afternoon with high temperatures around 51 degrees. Forecast for Friday and Friday night, rain with high temperatures around 50 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you very much for tuning into a Juneau afternoon today, and have a great day and evening.